Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you so much, Rob, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop, Metastatic Breast Cancer Treatment Updates. And today's program is supported by Novartis Oncology and made possible through an independent grant from Merck and Company, Inc., and I really want to thank them for their support of this program. Now, before I introduce our first speaker, I just want to say a few words about the people on the call today. We have over 125 participants on this program today. You come from all of the United States, from both urban, rural, suburban, and frontier communities. And we also have a number of international participants from Lebanon, Manila, Philippines, Romania, Switzerland, Uganda, and the United Kingdom. So this is truly a global call. It's a credit to each of you that you've chosen to spend this next hour with us. And now it is my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Ashley Matus-Fisher. And Dr. Matus-Fisher is breast medical oncologist, Atrium Health, Levine Cancer Institute. And Dr. Matus-Fisher will be addressing overview of metastatic breast cancer and current standard of care, new treatment approaches, and updates on clinical trials, how clinical research increases treatment options. It's really now my great pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Matus-Fisher.
Hi, thanks so much, Dr. Messner, for the introduction. It's truly my pleasure to be here today to discuss this important topic of metastatic breast cancer. So metastatic breast cancer is also commonly referred to as stage 4 breast cancer, and this means that the breast cancer has left the breast and spread to another part of the body or parts of the body. The most common organs that we see breast cancer spread to typically can be the bones, liver, lung, and brain. Stage 4 breast cancer can be found with imaging scans typically. So this could be through CAT scans or bone scans, MRIs, or a PET scan. Once the imaging test is performed and shows us where the suspicious area for cancer is located, then a biopsy is done to confirm that this is breast cancer and also the specific type of breast cancer. When we look at treating metastatic breast cancer in general, our goal is either to shrink the cancer or prevent the cancer from growing and spreading any further. Typically, although there are rare exceptions, surgery is not performed on the breast because removing the cancer from the breast has not been shown to really help once the cancer has spread to other areas of the body. Another modality of treatment that people typically think of when we think of breast cancer is radiation. And radiation may be used for certain situations in metastatic breast cancer, but it's often used on other areas of the body and actually not the breast. The two main reasons that we typically use radiation, one is to help treat cancer if it has spread to the brain. And this can be in the form of something we call SRS, and this targets a specific area in the brain. Or if there's multiple areas of cancer that are in the brain, then sometimes something called whole brain radiation may be given. The other reason we often use radiation is to help with pain that's being caused by one of the cancerous tumors. And we usually refer to this as palliative radiation. And this can sometimes quickly gain control of that pain. Anytime radiation is being considered, the patient would, of course, be seen in consultation with a radiation oncologist, and then they would discuss all of this in great detail and give their recommendations. But typically, the mainstay of treatment for metastatic breast cancer will be treatments in the form of pills or injections or infusions, because these treatments will treat the whole body as opposed to just one area like the breast. And although over time, we may change the drug or the drugs that we are getting a patient, most patients will remain on some form of treatment lifelong in order to keep the cancer suppressed as best as we can. The specific type of treatment that we use is based largely on the type of breast cancer a patient has. So most commonly, we define breast cancer into three different categories. Hormone receptor positive is the first one. You might also hear this referred to as estrogen receptor positive or ER positive breast cancer. HER2 positive is the other type, and then triple negative. And the treatment for each type varies greatly, so it's really important to know the receptor status in order for us to best plan the treatment. And so I want to focus on each type of breast cancer as I discuss current treatment standards, new treatment approaches, and clinical trials. So first, we'll start with hormone receptor positive breast cancers. This is the most common type of breast cancer we see. Because this type of breast cancer is thought to be driven by estrogen and/or progesterone, the first line of treatment is usually with a type of pill that blocks hormones. The most common pills that we use are in a class of drugs called aromatase inhibitors. And the two main drugs in this class that most people have probably heard of are letrozole or anastrozole. Typically, these are paired with another pill from a different class of drugs called CDK4/6 inhibitors, which stands for cyclin-dependent kinase 4 and 6. The three main drugs in this class are palbociclib, ribociclib, and abemaciclib. And these work by really interrupting the cancer cell's ability to grow and divide. All of these are good drugs, and physicians will discuss with their patients which pair of these drugs works best based on the different potential side effect profile of each drug, and then also based on other medical issues that a patient may already have so that we can limit the side effects that they might encounter. Patients can stay on these drugs for many years. If a patient needs to switch to a different treatment, there's typically additional testing done at that time to evaluate for specific markers in the tumor cells. If the tumor has a marker that we can target with one of our drugs, then we will typically discuss using that drug as our next option. Some of the markers that we're looking at to help guide our decision on the next best treatment include mutations in ESR1, something called PIK3CA, or AKT or P10 pathway alterations. And I believe that some of these will be touched on a little bit more with the next speaker on her topic. There are a lot of clinical trials being done in this space currently, looking at different markers to target, different drug combinations, and identifying which patients will benefit the most based on their tumor characteristics. And I think also important to note is that in these trials, we're always looking at side effects and ensuring that quality of life is also upheld when we're trying these different new treatments. I'm now going to switch to the HER2-positive breast cancer, which is treated differently than hormone receptor-positive breast cancer. HER2 stands for human epidermal growth factor 2, and most patients with HER2-positive metastatic breast cancer we'll start on a treatment regimen that consists of chemotherapy given through an IV and two HER2 targeted drugs. These are also typically given through an IV, although there are kind of new formulations coming out that some of these things can be given subcutaneously as well. The HER2-targeted drugs are trastuzumab and pertuzumab, and patients typically stay on these drugs every 3 weeks for approximately 5 or 6 months, and then at that time, typically the chemotherapy drug is often removed, and then patients will continue on something we call a maintenance HER2-targeted therapy every 3 weeks. These HER2-targeted infusions do not have side effects like chemo, and although they can still cause some fatigue and possibly diarrhea, overall, they're much, I would say, easier to tolerate on a day-to-day basis or a week-to-week basis in this case. There is a small risk of cardiac toxicity with these HER2-targeted drugs. And so while you are receiving these drugs, There will be required ultrasounds of the heart at certain intervals, and this is just to make sure that the heart remains healthy during the treatment. There's currently a clinical trial titled DESTINY-Breast09, and this is evaluating a drug called trastuzumab deruxtecan. And they're looking to see if this might be better than the current treatment regimen that we're using that I mentioned above. We're always trying to find treatments that improve outcomes and quality of life in our patients, and this drug has shown a lot of promise. Trastuzumab deruxtecan is in a class of drugs called ADCs, which stands for antibody drug conjugates. There are many ADCs approved and being studied, but this one has really shown great results in breast cancer. The benefit to ADCs in general is that the anti-cancer drug is targeted at the cancer cells, hopefully sparing the healthy cells and limiting side effects. Lastly, I'll discuss triple negative breast cancer. So triple negative breast cancer gets its name because it lacks the three receptors, estrogen, progesterone, and HER2. Typically, a combination of chemotherapy with or without immunotherapy is used first. Immunotherapy is a cancer treatment that's given in many different kinds of cancers and is typically given through an IV as well, through an infusion. Immunotherapy is unique because it harnesses the body's immune system to fight the cancer. Because of this mechanism, it does not have the same side effects as chemotherapy, but it does give us a different way to try to stop the cancer from growing. Patients with triple negative breast cancer are more likely to have a BRCA mutation. Although BRCA mutations can be seen in any type of breast cancer, if they do have a BRCA mutation that has been found, then a class of drugs called PARP inhibitors could also be utilized. PARP stands for poly-ADP ribose polymerase, and it's a protein in our cells that helps damaged cells repair themselves. PARP inhibitors stop the PARP from repairing cancer cells, and that can lead to cancer cell death. There are many trials ongoing looking at different combinations of chemotherapy, immunotherapy, ADCs for patients with triple negative breast cancer. And there's also a lot of research looking into different biomarkers or mutations in the tumors as well to see if we can target these. And kind of switching gears a little bit to talk about clinical research. So, you know, I do feel that clinical research is vital to improve outcomes. Through clinical trials, we are able to investigate new drugs and new drug combinations with the goal of finding a treatment that can work better than the current standard that we have. Sometimes studies will often ask permission as well from patients to take a closer look at their tumor samples that we've gotten at the time of biopsy, or take a closer look at their blood samples, so that we can evaluate the tumor microenvironment better. I like to think of the tumor microenvironment as sort of the neighborhood that surrounds the tumor cells. And so knowing the neighborhood is important because it can give us clues as to how the tumor likes to grow or spread. And the better we can understand this, the better we can hopefully devise treatments to halt that tumor growth. Clinical trials of drugs typically advance through several phases before being approved to test their safety and their effectiveness. And so typically the FDA will require a drug go through three phases, and each phase has a different purpose. So a phase one clinical trial typically is testing an experimental drug in a very small number of people. It's testing its safety, and also trying to define the best dose of the drug to give. A phase two trial includes more people and tests the effectiveness of a drug, and it's given in patients with a certain disease. And we continue to examine the safety and the side effects as well. And then a phase three trial gathers additional information from lots of people. These trials can be as large as a few thousand people. It often compares a new drug or a drug combination with other treatments that are already being used. And if the treatment being tested is just as good or better than the standard treatment, then it will get approved for use. I believe that patients should be offered clinical trial options whenever available during their journey with breast cancer. Patients who participate in clinical trials at any stage of their disease can benefit, including access to these, you know, new or novel therapies. I know that many times, especially if you have a new diagnosis of metastatic breast cancer, everything can seem a bit overwhelming, and sometimes adding information about a clinical trial can seem like information overload on top of, you know, the information overload that's already there. And so I think that if there are clinical trial options for you, it is absolutely okay to take time to process that, understand, ask questions, and doing all this without feeling rushed or pressured. Many times, you know, I think patients may turn away from a clinical trial because they're very unfamiliar with the process. But as physicians, we are here to guide you to make the best decision for you and help answer all of your questions as it pertains to treatment options. And that includes clinical trials as well. And so with that, I will conclude it, turn it back over.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Matusisha. That was just a stellar, wonderful presentation. You really are the first speaker in the program, so you set the tone for today's program. And I know there'll be lots of questions for you during the Q&A. Very comprehensive. Thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Tiffany Unger. And Dr. Unger is Associate Staff, Breast Medical Oncology, Equity, Diversity, Inclusion, Taussig Cancer Center. And Dr. Unger will be addressing biomarkers, diagnostic testing, technologies, why they are important in informing treatment decisions for metastatic breast cancer, preventing and managing treatment side effects, symptoms, discomfort, quality of life concerns and pain, and guidelines to prepare for telehealth, telemedicine appointments, including technology, prepared list of questions, and discussion of open notes. It's really my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Unger.
Thank you for that lovely introduction, Dr. Messner. As mentioned, my name is Dr. Tiffany Unger, and I'm a medical oncologist at the Cleveland Clinic in Cleveland, Ohio. My practice is dedicated exclusively to the care of patients with breast cancer, and I'm honored to continue today's conversation about metastatic breast cancer. Dr. Matus-Fisher discussed the three major biomarkers that are assessed at the time of diagnosis, including ER, PR, and HER2. I'll cover additional biomarkers that are identified at the time of progression using next-generation sequencing. So let's just consider a little bit of a historical perspective about cancer care. While chemotherapy was once a cornerstone of metastatic breast cancer treatment, advances in the science have introduced what we now call precision medicine. This technology is a method by which we are able to provide a more tailored approach to cancer care, and this is based upon the specific molecular makeup of your cancer cells. An analogy might be in the case of a blood transfusion. The blood you receive is tailored specifically to your specific type of blood. This precision medicine technology allows doctors to match the right treatment to the unique characteristics of each patient's cancer. You might wonder how your medical team gathers such important and personalized information on your tumor. This information is gathered sometimes through blood tests, which may be called a liquid biopsy, and other times this information is gathered from running tests on the biopsy of the tumor itself. The specific testing that is performed is called next generation sequencing, or NGS for short. NGS is a test that looks for specific mutations in cancer cells. You can think of that word mutation as changes. Looking for changes in the cancer genes is important because the results of NGS testing can open up treatment options that your doctor would not have been aware of otherwise. When these genes that are checked are germline genes, your doctor has information about mutations that might run in your family. In both cases, either mutations in family genes or mutations in the cancer itself. Certain mutations have FDA-approved treatments for them. Your doctor would know to consider those treatments without the information from the NGS, which is why it's so important. Additionally, some mutations may point towards clinical trials that are open only for people that carry a specific mutation. Asking your doctor about NGS testing could open the door to additional treatment options for metastatic breast cancer. Let's consider a few of the common mutations. Let's consider a woman who has metastatic, hormone-positive HER2-negative breast cancer. As mentioned before, the current first treatment for most patients would be a CDK4/6 inhibitor with an aromatase inhibitor. Many patients will ask me, are there treatment options after this? I generally tell them that at the time of progression, I consider three options. First, what is the standard of care? Meaning, what is the next step according to well-established guidelines, such as those mentioned in the NCCN, the National Comprehensive Cancer Network? Second, I consider what options are available according to the NGS report. And third, I consider what clinical trial options might be appropriate at this time. I review that information with my patient, and we decide on a treatment plan. At the time of progression, meaning once scans show that the medicine is not working, the medicine or treatment is not working as well as it should to control the cancer, your doctor might use NGS to look for mutations. One of the common mutations in this population is the ESR1 gene. ESR1 stands for estrogen receptor 1. When this gene is mutated or changed, endocrine therapy, such as aromatase inhibitors, don't work as well. Currently, elacestrant is an approved oral medication that is effective for patients with metastatic hormone-positive HER2-negative breast cancer. Metastatic triple-negative and HER2-positive breast cancers also benefit from NGS testing. For example, someone with a mutation in the BRCA gene might benefit from a pill called olaparib. Finally, tissue testing should be offered to assess for PD-L1 CPS, or the combined positive score, which is important to determine whether immunotherapy may be an option. While precision medicine and targeted therapies offer more effective treatments, side effects are still a reality for many patients. Let's talk about how to manage some of the most common ones, such as menopausal symptoms, fatigue, pain, and neuropathy. Menopausal symptoms are quite common for women going through cancer care. Symptoms such as hot flashes and vaginal dryness are some of the most common complaints. There are multiple treatments for hot flashes, such as venlafaxine, gabapentin, even vitamin E and magnesium. There are also things that you can do with regards to your diet and lifestyle, such as asking your doctor if it's safe to consume soy, as in soy milk, tofu, or edamame. Additionally, avoiding things like caffeine and alcohol can help reduce hot flashes. There's also a specific medication called Veozah that has been developed to help women with bothersome hot flashes. Vaginal dryness, similarly, has many remedies, including topical moisturizers like Replenz or silicone-based lubricants like Uberlube. There are many options that we can consider to alleviate the menopausal side effects that are so common in women going through cancer treatment, many that are not hormone-based and do not increase your risk for breast cancer progression. Additionally, fatigue is a common complaint for cancer patients. In fact, nearly all patients with cancer will experience fatigue at some point in their care, which can feel very different from everyday tiredness. This fatigue may not improve with rest, And sometimes even small tasks can feel absolutely overwhelming. Fatigue may be caused by the cancer itself, or like treatments such as chemotherapy, radiation, or endocrine therapy, or other issues like infections or anemia. The first step in managing fatigue is to identify any underlying cause. Such as if a patient has anemia, we would want to treat them with a blood transfusion, or if they have an infection, we want to treat it with antibiotics. Another powerful tool in combating fatigue, however, is exercise. Research has shown that regular, moderate exercise, 30 minutes a day, 5 days a week, can significantly improve the quality of life during treatment. I often let my patients know we don't have to jump up and do 30 minutes, you know, all at once. We can break it up into time chunks. And if you're somebody who does not have a habit of exercise, even starting with small amounts, 5 minutes a day, just walking around the block with a loved one, can be helpful. These are simple, low-cost options that don't require adding any additional medication. Pain is another common complaint for cancer patients, especially when cancer affects organs or bones. Pain can be worsened by mood changes like anxiety and depression, so addressing these issues through counseling or medication can help improve pain management. For pain related to cancer in the bones, radiation therapy can provide lasting relief. Additionally, a palliative medicine doctor can work with you to create a comprehensive pain management plan, which may include oral medications to alleviate the cycle of pain. Finally, neuropathy is unfortunately very common, especially in patients receiving chemotherapy and antibody drug conjugates. These types of treatments can affect the small nerves, particularly in the hands and feet. The best approach to neuropathy is prevention, and cryotherapy using cold-based treatments can be very helpful during infusion to reduce the incidence of neuropathy. Cold gloves or socks are worn to reduce the blood flow to these areas, limiting the amount of treatment that reaches them. This technique can also be used to prevent mouth sores and even taste changes. For those who already have neuropathy, medications like duloxetine or gabapentin can be effective. Complementary therapies like acupuncture can also provide relief to some patients. There are many potential side effects to effective cancer treatments, but thankfully there's much that we can do to reduce their impact on your quality of life. Talking with your oncologist and a palliative medicine doctor can be an important step in improving your overall well-being. By addressing these key side effects and focusing on overall well-being, your cancer team can make your cancer journey as manageable as possible. In addition to these efforts, there's one more area I'd like to touch on, preparing for telemedicine appointments. Telemedicine allows patients to connect with their doctors remotely, often over platforms like Zoom. In preparation for your visit, it's important to find a quiet spot with a good Wi-Fi connection so you can see and hear your doctor clearly. To make the most of your virtual visits, I recommend writing down questions beforehand, so you can set the agenda and ensure all your questions are addressed, and it even helps to bring a friend. Some questions you may want to ask include, what is your experience in treating patients like me? Do you offer clinical trials? How did you select this particular patient for me? What are the side effects? What are your expectations of how my tumor will respond? What are my other options? Would palliative medicine be helpful for me? How can I be strong through treatment, and how can I minimize side effects? Additionally, ask if you'll have access to the doctor's notes after the visit. At Cleveland Clinic, for example, patients can view their doctor's notes through our electronic health record system, and this can be a useful way to review what was discussed, ensure that what was discussed is accurate, and prepare yourself for future visits. In closing, metastatic breast cancer is a complex disease, but advancements in systemic therapies and precision medicine are providing more targeted and effective treatment options all the time. Whether it's addressing the cancer itself or managing the side effects like menopausal symptoms, fatigue, pain, and neuropathy, the goal is always to improve your quality of life during treatment and after treatment. Remember, the journey through cancer care is a partnership. By discussing options like next-generation sequencing with your cancer team, managing symptoms proactively, and preparing for every type of visit, including telemedicine, you play an active role in your care. There's no one-size-fits-all approach, but together with your doctor, you can create a treatment plan that's personalized to you, ensuring not only that your disease is treated, but that you are supported as a whole person. Thank you for your time and for the opportunity to share this with you today. Please stay tuned to hear from Cassie Spector, who will share some of Cancer Care's national free programs and services.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Ungerg. That was a stellar presentation. Really outstanding, covering a wide range of topics. I know there'll be lots of questions to you during the Q&A, but just a wonderful presentation and very eloquent and also very compassionate. So thank you. Thank you so much. And our next speaker is Ms. Cassie Spector. And Ms. Spector is an oncology social worker. She's our breast and gynecological cancer programs coordinator at Cancer Care, and she'll be addressing Cancer Care's free programs and services. She'll talk about how to contact our Hope Line and our website as well. It's really my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Spector.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. As mentioned, my name is Cassie, and I'm the breast and gynecological cancers program coordinator, as well as an oncology social worker at Cancer Care. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization providing free professional support services and information to help people manage the emotional, practical, and financial challenges of cancer. Our comprehensive services include resource navigation, counseling, support groups, educational workshops, publications, and limited financial assistance. Individuals diagnosed with metastatic breast cancer may choose to supplement their existing social networks by joining a support group or engaging in counseling. Many hospitals, treatment centers, and nonprofit organizations offer supportive services as well. Being a member of a support group can offer the opportunity to speak with others who are going through similar experiences as you are, obtain information, and provide support. Currently, Cancer Care offers a specific metastatic breast cancer support group online. The Metastatic Breast Cancer Online Support Group aims to reduce feelings of loneliness and anxiety, explore new ways of coping, increase feelings of hope and empowerment, provide practical information about treatment and resources, and address ways to communicate with your medical team and loved ones. Our online support groups take place using a password-protected message board format and are led by professional oncology social workers who offer support and guidance. Groups are held for 15 weeks at a time, and group members must register to join. You can register for an online support group through Cancer Care's website, cancercare.org, by selecting our services and then going to support groups. After you complete the registration process on our website, members can participate by posting in the groups 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Individuals may also experience practical and financial concerns throughout one's treatment. Please know if you're encountering such financial hardships, there are organizations that may be able to help you. Cancer Care offers resource navigation services that are short-term and strength-based approach service for patients and for caregivers affected by cancer nationally. A trained specialist will work with the client in connecting them to resources, referrals, and financial assistance. If you're interested in learning more about the support services we offer, I encourage you to call Cancer Care's National Hope Line at 800-813-4673 to speak with one of our oncology social workers. At Cancer Care, our oncology social workers are trained in how metastatic breast cancer diagnosis can impact an individual as well as their loved ones. We are here to offer you support throughout this experience, and we look forward to hearing from you. It's been a pleasure to be part of this very informative program. Thank you so much for your attention, and I'll turn it back to Dr. Messner.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Spector. That was just a wonderful presentation. Very stellar and very comprehensive in terms of all the services that Cancer Care offers. Thank you so much. I know there are questions to you during the Q&A as well. And now we're going to move right on to the question and answers, and I'm going to bring all of our speakers on board. And I'm going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. I'm going to ask Rob to explain to you how to queue up for online questions. And again, we'll take as many of your questions as possible. Rob?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
And I have a question for Dr. Matus Fisher. I've read patients with invasive lobular breast cancer have a higher risk of developing leptomeningeal disease. What are the symptoms and what tests would diagnose the serious condition?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And so really anyone who has cancer that's gone to the brain or what we call the CNS, so that can be the leptomeninges, we oftentimes will ask you if you're having new headaches, if you're having any dizziness, any sort of kind of issues with concentration or thinking, things like that, is something that you would want to report to your physician. Typically, the first test we would get would be an MRI of the brain to look for anything. You potentially would maybe need an MRI of the spine, and sometimes spinal taps are done if needed. That's not always needed, but that's where they would go in and get fluid from the back too if they wanted to look at the fluid for any of the cells. But our imaging is quite good nowadays, where a lot of times it could be seen on MRI. But I think that's when it's important just to make sure you're communicating any kind of new symptoms you have like that to your physician so they can get the appropriate workup.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Another question for Dr. Unger. Is use of another CDK drug after a long break from previous CDK drug worth considering?
That's a great question. Thank you for asking that. The recent data shows that you can do what we call switch therapy, where we move from one aromatase inhibitor and CDK4/6 inhibitor to another. And in somebody that I would consider an ideal candidate for, that would be someone that's had a longer duration on their initial treatment. In general, due to the more updated information that we have, I favor abemaciclib or ribociclib as options when transitioning from one CDK6 inhibitor to another. And then I also might consider changing the endocrine backbone. So perhaps one was started on an aromatase inhibitor, and at the time of switching, I might consider fulvestrant, which is a different type of endocrine therapy.
Thank you so much. Thank you. I had a question for Dr. Matus Fisher. Any good treatment for diarrhea from Verzenio? Do you think there are other medications that are just as effective that do not have that side effect?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And the Verzenio, which is abemaciclib, is the diarrhea is known to be one of the side effects that can be the toughest ones to kind of deal with. And so oftentimes Imodium is what I use first. A lot of times people can probably take more Imodium than what they are. So I always tell them take two pills the first time and then go ahead and take it again with each additional bowel movement, at least a few more times during that day to see if we can kind of max out the Imodium we're taking. You can also use something a little bit stronger called Imodo to help with diarrhea. And then, we can dose reduce the Verzenio. And there's actually been some data that was shown that says, you know, the benefit is really still good even if we dose reduce a little bit. So a lot of my patients do have a difficult time tolerating the full dose, and so sometimes the next lower dose is a little bit better tolerated. The last thing I'll say about this is, you know, we kind of have those three different drugs that we talked about. So you have the Verzenio or the abemaciclib, and then the ribociclib and the palbociclib, and they all have very similar efficacy with a little bit different side effect profile. So I've definitely had patients who, you know, had so much diarrhea with the Verzenio that we did switch to a different drug that has less of a diarrhea side effect, and they have done well on that one too. So that is another option too.
Excellent to have these options. That's excellent. Thank you. Thank you so much. Question for Dr. Unger, did you want to say something? Or?
Sure. So one other thing that I think about for these patients is sometimes I'll start at a lower dose and then ramp up slowly over time just to kind of let the body adjust. Unfortunately, diarrhea is a very common side effect. In addition to, you know, making sure that you are taking the appropriate amount of anti-diarrhea medications. I even find some benefit in patients adjusting their diet to include more fiber. Sometimes that can help a little bit as well.
Thank you. Thank you. And another question for Dr. Unger. Do you find that the cold mittens socks help prevent chemo-induced neuropathy?
I do. And so I ask my patients to use cold socks and cold mittens anytime they're receiving a IV chemotherapy or an antibody drug conjugate. Additionally, some patients will use this cold therapy for reducing hair loss. This is more so in the early stage, rather than metastatic stage, but patients do find benefit and using cryo-based therapy, meaning cold-based therapy, for various side effects related to their cancer treatment, including chemotherapy and antibody drug conjugates. Not to mention using very cold water, ice water, drinking slushies to help reduce some of the taste changes that can happen with these types of agents as well. Taste changes are one of the most common and bothersome side effects, but that's an easy thing that we can offer to try to reduce the impact that taste changes has on the quality of life.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Thanks. These are really such wonderful solutions when you think about it. Amazing. Thank you. And another question for Dr. Matus Fisher. Besides Kadcycla and Erutu, both used in HER2, which treatments penetrate the blood-brain barrier?
Yeah, so that's a great question. You know, we always want to try to give treatments, especially for HER2-positive, that can affect go through the blood-brain barrier. So there's a drug called tucatinib that is also being commonly used in combination that has pretty good data for helping with cancer in the CNS as well. And like was mentioned, the Enhertu, there's also been data that shows that is doing pretty well in the CNS too.
Awesome, thank you. And question for Dr. Unger, if a metastatic triple progress on Keytruda, would you retest the PD-L1 to see if a patient no longer overexpresses it?
Can you repeat that? I apologize.
Yes, if a metastatic triple, I'm assuming it's triple negative, progress on Keytruda, would you retest the PD-L1 to see if a patient no longer overexpresses it?
Okay. So I understand the question to be, if somebody was initially on a PD-L1 targeting medication with triple negative breast cancer and the cancer started to grow on this treatment, would there be a role for retesting the PD-L1 to see if future checkpoint inhibitors might be helpful? In general, I consider patients who are progressing on a particular checkpoint inhibitor to have developed a way to outsmart their current PD-L1 inhibitor. So what we know, for example, is that in hormone-positive breast cancers, that there can be a time where the cancer cells have learned to outsmart the endocrine therapy that has been offered. And so if we re-biopsy, a lot of times the estrogen receptor is still there, but it's not the primary method by which the cancer is continuing to grow. And so similarly, when patients have PD-L1 positive tumors and they're on a checkpoint inhibitor, some type of immunotherapy, there is a consideration that the cancer has learned to outsmart checkpoint inhibitor therapy. And so if I were to switch, and this would be more common in the clinical trial standpoint, I would want to make sure that I'm switching two aspects. If I'm going to try another checkpoint inhibitor, I would want to maybe consider switching two aspects of that regimen. So perhaps I would switch the immunotherapy as well as some type of chemotherapy or some type of antibody drug conjugate, some other aspect to provide a more robust response.
Cool. Thank you. Thanks so much. These are wonderful questions, but our speakers are really giving terrific answers for all of you as well. Another question for Dr. Matus-Fisher. What was the HER2 clinical trial drug, and where is the trial being conducted?
The ENHERTU clinical trial. So I believe it's the one I probably mentioned about the DESTINY-Breast09. So this is one of the, it's called ENHERTU, and it's actually, they're supposed to present out some data for this soon at our next big meeting. The drug is basically, I will tell you, it's been approved in a lot of different spaces now. It used to just be for HER2-positive metastatic breast cancer, and they've started looking at HER2 positivity a little bit differently. This is something that we didn't really touch on in the talk, but I'll go a little bit into it because I think it's helpful. So HER2 positive, when they look at this on a biopsy, they do some staining. And they basically stain, and the pathologist looks at it, and they'll either call it a 1 plus, 2 plus, or 3 plus based on how much it's staining. And if they call it a 3 plus, that tells someone that their tumor is HER2 positive. If they call it a 1 plus or less, then typically speaking, that one would be not enough to say that there's enough staining to call it a HER2 positive tumor. And then there was a middle ground of a 2 plus read, and that would go for some confirmatory testing that we would call FISH. And that would look to kind of confirm whether or not someone had HER2 positive breast cancer. So recently, they've started using this ENHERTU in patients who not only were HER2 positive, but even in HER2, what we're calling low samples, meaning historically, we probably wouldn't have tried this drug in those patients, but there's actually been studies to show that it's helpful even in those types of patients. And so this drug has been, I think it's done really great for a lot of different kind of cancers, whether the HER2 positive or not. But yes, this trial is going to, I think, report out soon and let us know if this drug is going to be something that kind of moves up into a sooner line of therapy for this kind of population.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Thank you. And a question for Dr. Unger. It's a bit of a long question, so so if you could answer this perhaps in a general way. Or I have a problematic team. I participated in a disappointing trial for an oral SERD. Fortunately, I was on the standard of care in Ibrance and Elektrosol, but I've had substantial trouble with Ibrance, and my doctor only gave me two options, stay on the Ibrance or rely solely on Elektrosol. Communication is extraordinarily difficult. She got quite angry when I asked about other CDK inhibitor. How do I deal with a narrow-minded defensive professional? Changing doctors would be difficult.
This is a difficult one. that is really tough. I'm so sorry that you're going through that. It's really important to be able to feel that you can communicate with your team and have an open space for collaboration and discussion about the various options. Sometimes it can be helpful to bring a advocate, whereas if you're bringing something up and you're, maybe not receiving the answers that you would like, to have another person kind of help to amplify your voice. Every now and then I'll use this, and if I'm, maybe talking with a friend and maybe they want me to do, something, I'll say, let me check with my husband because he's going to want to know all the details and all the questions. And sometimes that can just take some of the pressure off of you, and you can just say something like, doc, I appreciate you saying this is the right thing, but my daughter, she's really going to want to know. She's been reading about this and that. What are your thoughts about this? Just so I can communicate with her about that. And so that might be a way where you're having trouble communicating, and changing doctors is not something that's feasible for one reason or another, to be able to get your questions answered. There also are organizations, the Cleveland Clinic included, that do virtual second opinions. And so sometimes we will offer this to patients. They don't even have to come to our facility to get this service. And we review the whole case and treatment that one has been through, and then we issue what our recommendation would be. And so we can offer that for patients. And a lot of times patients will seek us out specifically for this service. And they can take that with them and just say, hey, I got a second opinion, and it sounds like this might be an option. And I also have patients that I do manage out of state, and some of it is for folks who are on orals, or, we're able to kind of communicate with a local oncologist who's in agreement with my plan, and we are able to work a little bit more collaboratively that way as well. But I'm sorry that you're going through this, but hopefully that might give you a few ideas that you could explore.
And that second opinion, isn't there a phone line that you can call or something at Cleveland Clinic?
Yes. Our appointment line will get you to the right team. I have my personal line for my team is 216-444-6833. Again, 216-444-6833. And you can ask for the cancer answer line, and they will get you connected, and they'll obtain the records. We also, if that doesn't work for whatever reason, you could also just ask for the kind of the second opinion line. They're kind of two different avenues where you still talk to the same doctors, honestly, and so you can kind of explore those two different options, because one of them is going to be more insurance-based, and then one of them is going to be more not insurance-based. So there's two different options there.
I have to say, over the years, I refer a number of people to that line. It's been incredibly helpful to people. So we'll include that. You'll all be getting a SurveyMonkey within a week of the program. It's an evaluation of the program, but it also includes any of the resources that we provide during the program itself. So just to be aware of that. So we'll include this as well with the information that Dr. Unger provided. And a question for Dr. Matus Fisher. I cannot continue on Ibrance. I understand that there are two other CDK inhibitors available, but if they're equally intolerable, are other treatment options other than letrozole? Right now, I have a small tumor burden.
So I think the question was asking if they're on Ibrance and letrozole, and if both of those are not tolerating well. I would say that yes. So you are correct in terms of, you know, with the Ibrance, there's two other drugs that are very similar in terms of their efficacy, and it is not uncommon to see someone switch to a different one if needed. And the other thing you mentioned was the letrozole. And yes, there are other, there's other aromatase inhibitors or, backbone. So I know Dr. Onger had mentioned, switching to fulvestrant backbone. So there's different ways to approach this. If you feel like you are having side effects, living with metastatic breast cancer, we want you to have your symptoms as well controlled as possible in addition to the breast cancer. And I think, we have multiple tools to be able to do that and multiple different drugs that are very similar but with very, different side effect potential profiles. So I think, I would talk to your physician about, is there another combination that we could use to see if it helps with my symptoms? I think that's a very reasonable conversation to have.
Thank you so much. And for Dr. Unger, first-line treatment for metastatic TNBC is often Trivaldi. Is that correct?
So it depends on a number of different things. We often will get next-generation sequencing first to assess what the specific biomarkers are to help guide that first-line therapy for metastatic triple-negative breast cancer. If there is PD-L1 positivity, then a lot of times the first-line therapy for metastatic triple-negative breast cancer is going to be a combination of chemotherapy with immunotherapy. This is with the Keynote regimen. We have one for the early stage or neoadjuvant setting, but we also have a Keynote regimen that's available for the metastatic setting. So the first thing that I do for metastatic triple negative patients is check that is to check the next generation sequencing. The second thing I include is the genetics. And that's specifically looking at the germline mutations, so those mutations that can run along family lines, because there are oral agents that are available for those patients in particular, in addition to, of course, clinical trial. And then if there's no clinical trials, there's no PD-L1 positivity, there's no BRCA mutation, then I typically move on to chemotherapy, followed by sometimes in HER2 if there's HER2 low, and then Trodelvy, specifically because Trodelvy was tested in the setting of after having been on one other agent. So there's a number of things that we can consider. So for metastatic triple negative breast cancer, it's very individualized, but that's one of the great things about the state of care today is that we are able to provide a more individualized care plan.
Well, excellent. Thank you so much. And a question from Ms. Spector. I'm very interested in joining a support group. What can I expect?
Absolutely. And I think that it depends, of course, on the type of support group that you do want to join. So there are support groups in person, there are support groups on Zoom, and then there's online message board groups, which is what I mentioned before that Cancer Care offers. So really figuring out what's going to be best for you if you find that at a specific day and time, you're able to get on Zoom and stay and be there, then that's great. Or if you find that your schedule more allows to like be on an online message board format, that's okay too. And there's different forms of support for different reasons. And really in terms of a group, what you can expect is being open to learning and hearing other people's experiences, and that can come with its benefits, and also it can be difficult to hear other people's experiences. So really checking in with yourself as you join a group and being able to hear what other people are saying, but as it can be so helpful, but it also can be difficult at times, so recognizing that. And then also what your comfort level is in sharing in a group. And sometimes you may feel very open to sharing in a group, and sometimes it may be more difficult for that as well. So really checking in with yourself on what you're hoping to gain from a group can be really helpful as you speak with the group moderator, as you figure out what type of group might work best for you.
Well, thank you so much. I want to thank all of our speakers and our participants. We took a lot of your questions, almost all of them, frankly, and our speakers were just, the questions were terrific, and our speakers were terrific in responding to them. But we've done other programs on metastatic breast cancer. Treatment updates, this has been by far the very best ever. I'm going to ask each of our speakers to provide a takeaway for each of you from today's program. I'm going to start with Dr. Ashley Matus-Fisher first.
Yeah, thank you. So I think just in general, metastatic breast cancer is really different depending on the type of it you have. So knowing the type and then talking with your doctor, I think, about if a treatment's not working for you, asking if there's reasonable alternatives that are similar so that we can have a really good quality of life while we're treating the breast cancer. The second thing that I want to say is, you know, asking your team about clinical trials, if there's any available, what they are. The more you ask about them and informed you are, just the more potential opportunities there are to get involved with it.
Well, thank you so much. And Dr. Unger?
Yes, I would like to say that we have more reason to be hopeful today than ever before. There are so many more treatments, clinical trials, targeted therapies, and we're really just learning more and more about how to provide the most effective care, more tolerable care, and folks are living longer and longer than they ever have with metastatic breast cancer, including triple negative, which used to really have a really poor prognosis. So I think we have a lot of reasons to be hopeful. And so I encourage folks to get those screenings. Sometimes people are afraid to get those screenings out of concern of what we'll find, but a lot of times what we're finding is that things, even if they are metastatic, are very treatable, and we can maintain a lot of quality of life as we work together.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you. And Ms. Spector?
Yeah, and I would say really just to know that you're not alone, whether you're looking for emotional support, financial support, practical resources, knowing there's organizations like Cancer Care, there may be local organizations, your treatment team, that can help point you in the right direction in terms of what might be helpful for you.
Well, thank you so much. I want to thank our speakers. You've been phenomenal. I want to thank our participants for asking such really great questions, really just terrific. And of course, we'll be doing this program again in the near future, but I just want to let you all know that this was really a spectacular program as far as we're concerned. Now, I do want to, many of you did have a chance to ask a question. For those of you who did queue up and had your question addressed by one of our speakers, please take your question back to Treating Healthcare Team. They know you the best, and so they also may be able to add some additional information to what you've learned today. Remember, you've learned a lot today, but they may be able to add some more. Remember, you've learned from what you've learned, you'll be able to hear their answers in a better way. And for those of you who did not have a chance to ask a question or thinking of a question to ask, again, go to your healthcare team and ask them the question. Remember, you've learned a lot, and it's very important that you all receive the very best care possible. Also, I just want to remind all of you that we've noticed that participants always have challenges reaching their healthcare team weekends, holidays, and evenings. It seems that during the day you can usually reach your healthcare team, but evenings, weekends, and holidays are often challenging. So what I would suggest is that you be sure and ask your healthcare team how can you reach them evenings, weekends, and holidays. Also, I just want to reiterate what many of our speakers have said, you're not alone. You're now part of a community of support, and we're all here to help you. And please do take advantage of some services of cancer care. And we will be providing other resources as well on this SurveyMonkey evaluation, as well as resources we mentioned during the program, including the Cleveland Cancer Center answer line for those of you wanting to get more information. Again, I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.